Bonsoir. Good evening, everybody. My name is Rosalie Jukier. I'm a professor here in the Faculty of Law. And together with Assistant Dean Véronique Bélanger, who you will meet shortly, I have the honor of co-organizing and co-chairing our continuing legal education program that we have entitled Think Ahead, Pensez d'Avance. J'ai le grand plaisir de vous accueillir à la Faculté de droit de McGill ce soir pour notre session inaugurale de formation continue pour l'année 2012-2013. Let me begin by apologizing for the temperature in this room. We have fallen victim to the infamous shoulder season. That's what happens when you are predicted to have a massive flooding rainstorm and it ends up being 20 degrees outside and the university can't shut down its heating system. I assure you that the ventilation is on full blast, so it certainly won't get worse, and I do appreciate your patience. It's hard to believe that we're beginning the fourth year of our Formation Continue series. Over the last 3 years, as part of what we consider our public service and educational outreach mission of the faculty, we have helped literally hundreds of lawyers and notaries meet their required hours of continuing legal education. But more importantly, we hope that we have done so in an enriching and interesting way, and in a way that lets you see the richness of the legal education and the wonderful professors our students experience in our faculty today. We continue to be heartened by the overwhelmingly positive response to our Formation Continue program. Not only do we continue to have very high enrollment, when there are today countless opportunities for you to obtain these CLE hours, it's become virtually a cottage industry, but we also continue to receive wonderful feedback. Some of you, and I just got an email to this effect last week, say to us that even though you already have your 30 hours, you're still coming because you find our evening so interesting. Et j'en suis certaine que ça continuera cette année, parce que pour cette année, nous avons conçu un programme de 5 soirées de conférences sur les développements récents dans nos tribunaux canadiens, surtout, mais pas seulement, la Cour suprême du Canada. Alors, nous allons parler de suicide assisté, tenant compte d'une décision récente en Colombie-Britannique, ainsi que les droits d'auteur, le droit international privé et la question controversée du niqab devant les tribunaux, tenant compte des décisions récentes de la Cour suprême. Tonight, we will be concentrating on what has come to be known as the Insight case. Canada, the AG of Canada versus PHS Community Services, and the social and legal implication of the Supreme Court's position on safe injection sites. I don't know if he has arrived already. He has arrived already, but we are delighted to have with us tonight Louis Letellier de Saint-Just, who is a lawyer and board member of CACTUS, an organization you'll be hearing about in a moment, and who represented CACTUS in its intervention at the Supreme Court in this case. Nous sommes ravis que vous êtes parmi nous ce soir. Before we begin with the formal part of our program, a few housekeeping announcements. Please turn off anything that buzzes or rings. We will, of course, have a break this evening, midway through our 2 speakers, so somewhere around 7:20, 7:25. However, we will be waiting until the end of the program for our Q&A. We will do that jointly with all our speakers at the very end. During the break, you can get some water and juice and some snacks from the table manned by our students in the atrium. The food is not for sale. Rather, the students would appreciate donations for what you take. And note that all the proceeds will go to support the Graduate Law Students Association, or as it's known, the GLSA. It's a student group to which all our master's and doctoral students here in the faculty belong. The GLSA represents the interests of graduate students on faculty council and various other committees. They organize an annual conference as well as many social, cultural, and academic activities. And I happen to be the Associate Dean Graduate Studies at the moment, so I urge you to be particularly generous. As in the past, you will receive shortly after this evening an email with an attestation of your 3 hours for tonight. Please make sure, however, that you have checked in, you've registered, because otherwise we won't send you this attestation. If you haven't done so, don't worry. You can do so by going to see one of the students in the atrium during the break. And finally, if you've been here before, then you know that a special feature of our series is to invite a distinguished member of the community to act as président d'honneur. And I would like to call upon my colleague, Véronique Bélanger, to introduce our président d'honneur tonight.
Bonsoir. C'est à mon tour de vous souhaiter la bienvenue à cette première conférence de l'année. Alors, j'ai grand plaisir de vous présenter notre président d'honneur de la soirée, M. Jean-François Marie, qui a gentiment accepté de prendre part à la conférence pour nous parler d'une réalité que la plupart d'entre nous ne connaissons en fait que très peu. Jean-François Marie est responsable de l'organisation communautaire et des communications à Cactus Montréal. Cactus Montréal est un groupe communautaire qui offre des services à des personnes qui consomment des drogues par injection et inhalation, ainsi qu'à des personnes qui pratiquent le travail du sexe dans le centre-ville de Montréal. Cactus Montréal fait partie des premiers programmes d'échange de seringues en Amérique du Nord, dont la mise en place s'est faite en 1989. Depuis bientôt 10 ans, l'organisme a fait la promotion des besoins de ses usagers en matière de services d'injection supervisée. Alors, je vous demande maintenant d'accueillir Jean-François Marie pour qu'il nous en dise un peu plus long sur Cactus et sur le travail qu'on y fait. Monsieur Marie.
Bonjour à tous. Comme ça a été dit dans la présentation, Cactus a été fondé en 89 pour venir répondre à une épidémie galopante de VIH qui sévissait à l'époque. Par absence de matériel stérile pour les personnes qui consommaient, ce matériel-là était non disponible car considéré illégal par la loi sur les drogues et autres substances. Malgré un flou juridique qui persiste encore jusqu'à ce jour, Cactus a mis sur pied en 89 un des tout premiers programmes d'échange de seringues. Un autre voyait le jour simultanément de l'autre côté du continent, à Vancouver, pour fournir des services qui existaient déjà depuis de nombreuses années outre-Atlantique, donc en Europe. Et face à cette épidémie-là, dans une époque aussi où il n'y avait pas de traitement pour le VIH, on voyait ces personnes-là qui tombaient comme des mouches, les unes après les autres mourir, après nombreuses souffrances, des maladies opportunistes qui venaient terminer leur jour brutalement. Et ces infirmiers et infirmières ont ouvert leurs portes à ces personnes-là, une nouvelle faune de nuit, venez rentrer en contact avec des personnes, des intervenants, qui jour après jour travaillaient avec eux, leur ouvraient leurs portes. Les travailleuses du sexe aussi, Cactus a ouvert ses portes dans l'ancien Red Light, actuellement qui est plutôt une zone désertique, mais qui à l'époque en tout cas était très en vie, et recevait aussi ces travailleuses du sexe. Et c'était le début de l'intervention auprès d'une population marginalisée, souvent à laquelle on refuse ses droits, déniée de droits, en fait des sans-droits, sans droit, sans toit, sans grand-chose en réalité. Et au cours de ces 23 années, Cactus a dépassé le simple fournisseur de matériel en développant différentes interventions pour répondre aux besoins de ces personnes-là, parmi lesquelles bien sûr du travail de rue, mais aussi un programme spécifique pour les personnes travesties, transsexuelles, marginalisées, un lieu d'accueil et d'implication sociale pour des personnes qui consomment, afin qu'elles regagnent un peu leur dignité et qu'elles regagnent un peu un sentiment de citoyenneté dans la société. Les services offerts actuellement à Cactus commencent à couvrir un large spectre de services, ce qu'on appelle dans le milieu un continuum. Mais ce continuum de services-là est incomplet. Puis on en vient au sujet de ce soir, les services d'injection supervisée. Depuis 23 ans, Cactus distribue du matériel à des personnes qui, pour certains, vont consommer dans les minutes qui suivent la sortie de notre porte. Cette hypocrisie-là dans laquelle on travaille, ce tabou qu'on entretient vis-à-vis de la consommation de drogue par injection, il mène des personnes dans des situations assez dramatiques. On pense souvent aux morts par overdose, mais les conséquences sont autres. Beaucoup de stress vécu par ces personnes-là qui leur font développer des psychoses. Une épidémie de VIH qui sévit toujours. 18% des personnes qui fréquentent Cactus sont atteintes du VIH. 68% d'entre elles sont atteintes de l'hépatite C. On est face à une situation de pandémie pour le cas de l'hépatite C. Et des personnes qui sont remises à consommer dans les ruelles, dans les arrières-cours. et bien souvent caché des regards, caché de tous, mais aussi caché de tous quand on fait une overdose, ça signifie la mort. Et donc depuis 2000, Cactus a commencé à faire de la pression pour que des services d'injection supervisée voient le jour dans le cadre de ces services. Et très vite, on s'est rendu compte que la loi sur les drogues ne permettait pas la mise en place légale de ces services-là. Donc, une lutte de plus, je pourrais dire, parce que Cactus a vécu de nombreuses luttes dans ces 23 années. Une lutte de plus commencée depuis 12 ans, donc les années tournent assez vite. Et jusqu'à ce que, encore une fois, de l'autre côté du continent, à Vancouver, des usagers de drogue se mobilisent pour ouvrir un service d'injection supervisée illégal, le 327 Carroll Street, qui, quelques mois plus tard, a donné lieu à la naissance de Insight, donc le premier lieu légal d'injection supervisée. Mais il faut savoir qu'un autre lieu qui n'a jamais demandé d'exemption existe aussi, le Dr. Peter Center, qui fournit des services d'injection supervisée sans toutefois avoir jamais demandé d'exemption à la loi sur les drogues, mais qui le fait dans le cadre de ses services. Et donc, en septembre 2011, on était présent pour ce jugement donc, qui est tombé en faveur d'Insight, mais je pense que vous allez le voir ce soir, qui nous laisse quand même de nombreuses questions. Je ne vais pas m'étendre plus encore, mais merci pour votre attention.
Merci beaucoup. Nous aurons le plaisir de réentendre M. Marie après les deux présentations qui va réagir et parler de l'impact de la décision dans son travail. Alors, nous allons maintenant vous présenter un court extrait d'un reportage préparé par la CBC dans le cadre de son émission The Fifth Estate. C'est un reportage dont nous verrons les 5 premières minutes et qui vous donnera une idée de ce que fait l'organisme Insight à Vancouver dont nous parlait M. Marie. Double click.
Medical staff are always on hand and provide everything, except the drugs. Addicts must bring the drugs and inject themselves.
Just wrap it around one time.
And you see if you need help with that. Sometimes, you know, we need
it. Right,
without the space. Without the space, you know, what would be like.
40-year-old David Broderick has been a user half his life. He's been coming to Insight since it opened 6 years ago.
My drug choice is cocaine and morphine, speedball, mixed together. And of course, I haven't chewed that because it's the most addictive and the hardest on your heart. Once I got HIV, I was just bent on self-destruction. I went on a vicious bank robbery spree. I got arrested. I was given 5.5 years in prison. My veins are shot from using dope.
Insight is the only place illegal drugs may be legally injected under federal law. They got the exemption in 2003 when the pilot project began as a response to an alarming rise in hepatitis C, HIV, and drug-related deaths. Working with the most deprived and destitute in Vancouver's downtown East Side for the past 10 years, Darwin Fisher has pretty much seen it all. Darwin is the intake manager at Insight.
For a lot of people, there are issues around the entry point of this place, the fact that people come in to inject.
The fact that they are coming in here will help save their lives. It'll help connect them. It's an entryway into society for a really marginalized population.
So it's a
big deal just walking through the front door. And we actually want to make the place available to people so we can try and, well, A, keep them alive, also establish relationships, and maybe get them to some services, improve the quality of their lives if they can.
Voilà. It's now my pleasure to introduce to you our first speaker tonight, Maître Alexander Pless. I'm delighted to invite Alexander Pless, a lawyer of the Department of Justice, to start off the evening with a discussion of the missed opportunities, questions, and implications of the PHS Community Services decision from the perspective of federalism. Mr. Pless, whom some of you have already had the pleasure of seeing here at the faculty, is a graduate of the faculty, a graduate of McGill, I should say, where he obtained his BA in philosophy, as well as his BCL and LLB from this faculty. He went on to pursue an MA in public administration from Harvard and became a member of the Quebec and New York bars. Maître Pless est aujourd'hui au service du ministère de la Justice du Canada. Il y occupe le poste de gestionnaire régional et avocat conseil à la direction du droit commercial. Maître Pless œuvre principalement en matière de droit constitutionnel, administratif et responsabilité de l'État. Before I ask you to welcome Maître Pless, though, I would like to signal the presence of a very special guest. Dr. Pless, Alex's father, is with us tonight. It's a rare treat in academia to speak before fans, so Alex, enjoy the moment. I would like to add that Dr. Pless is celebrating tonight a very special birthday, celebrating his 80th birthday, and we are very honored to have him with us on such a special occasion. Happy birthday to you, Dr. Pless. And now, please join me to welcome the other Mr. Pless.
That's my way of apologizing, of accepting the talk on your 80th birthday. What they asked was, could you do it on the 23rd? I said, no, I'm doing a talk that week in Ottawa. And they said, how about the next week? And, you know, that was 7 plus 23 was too complicated. Just get the... So, go like that. Is it playing, Alana? Is it playing? Yes. All right. It's the first time using this Prezi software, which looks amazing. We'll just see how it turns out in practice. Thank you very much for the kind introduction. It's really a privilege and a pleasure to be here today. I'll give you a quick overview of my remarks. We'll start with a quick summary of the decision. I recognize that not everybody reads every single decision on charter review of administrative decisions or federalism, so we'll try to give you enough of a review of the decision that you're able to have a sense of the problems that we're talking about. In the first part of my remarks, I want to try to answer the question, does the decision in InSight mean that that any province now could open a Safe and Jackson site, that we have essentially a constitutional right to have a Safe and Jackson site in Canada? And I'll give you a hint, in case from time to time you're not paying attention, the answer, in my opinion, is no. It doesn't mean that at all, and I think that because it doesn't mean that, and because I think the video gives you a sense of the enormous social and human problems that are at stake in the decision, because it doesn't mean that, and because it doesn't provide certainty for the future, I think that it is particularly regrettable that the Supreme Court turned its back on an opportunity to, instead of resolve this problem through the charter means, on the facts of that particular case, that they didn't see the difficulty that this presented for our federation, and they didn't try to say something progressive about federalism that would have also provided a solution. I think we can all imagine the Supreme Court justices being moved by the human dimension of this problem and wanting to find a solution. They chose a solution in Section 7. But they could have chosen a solution by saying something novel about federalism, and they chose not to. They chose to maintain, and I should say, I imagine that it's the position that was advanced by the Attorney General of Canada, and it's consistent with the, oh dear, it was consistent with the existing jurisprudence. What I'm going to suggest to you today is that it would have been possible to say something new about federalism that would have provided a different result. And finally, I want to emphasize that the views that I express here today are not those, of course, of the Attorney General of Canada. I don't speak on behalf of the Attorney General of Canada. I also teach at the faculty. Perhaps my views could be attributed to the faculty, Rosalie? Sure. I don't speak on behalf of the Attorney General of Canada, and in particular, I have no knowledge of the PHS case other than reading it, like you. I'm a person who's interested in the charter review of administrative decisions. I'm interested in Canadian federalism, but I don't know. Health Canada is not one of my clients, and I suspect that if I had knowledge of what was going on in this area, the department wouldn't have authorized me to come and speak with you. So I read this decision like any of you can, and I think in particular, because I'd like to emphasize the federalism issue in this, I read it and I worry about it from a point of view of a citizen who's very interested in federalism and what the court could do to tell us to advance federalism so that it makes Canada a better place to live. So the decision. The decision begins, this is the very first paragraph of the decision. It tells us that since 2003, the InSight safe injection site, the very injection site that you saw in the video, and the only safe injection site in Canada, has provided medical services to intravenous drug users in downtown east side of Vancouver. Local, provincial, and federal authorities came together to create a legal framework for a safe injection facility in which clients could inject drugs under medical supervision without the fear of arrest or prosecution. The judgment recognizes that this initiative was taken as a result of what was considered by the provincial authorities as a health emergency in this tiny little area of Vancouver, the downtown east side, a physically small area. There were 4,600 intravenous drug users with epidemic rates of drugs, of disease and infection among that community. So, the safe injection site was established as an experiment to see if if the health concerns of those of that community could be addressed or diminished by providing them a safe injection site. The Supreme Court describes the initiative as a product of cooperative federalism. At the very end of my remarks, and perhaps in answer to questions, I'll have some observations about this, what I consider to be a new vogue for the Supreme Court to attach that label to initiatives that they consider important, and then to structure their decisions in a way that foster cooperative federalism. And I would suggest to you that, in fact, there is, I won't say nothing, but there's not much about the federal structure in Canada which was intended to design that you would identify legitimate policy initiatives and say that they can only be accomplished through the cooperation of federal and provincial governments. Very importantly, the underlining only managed to stay on the. But in fact, I meant to underline, and pointing it out like this surely emphasizes it more, that the court found that the experiment was proven successful. We're talking about a finding of fact. This is a quote from the judgment. The experiment had proven successful. Insight has saved lives and improved the health of its users. So because the analysis of the court is focused on Section 7 of the Charter, which is triggered by an infringement of life, liberty, and security of the person, the trial judge's finding, a finding of fact, that Insight saved lives and improved health is a very important one. So this is the finding of fact that the court is faced with. A safe injection site, of course, or perhaps not of course, but it turns out to be the case, that you can't operate a safe injection site without running afoul of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. I asked a criminal prosecutor before we came here today to make sure I understood this correctly, and her silence I took as assent that it's a question of constructive possession that the operators of the site would have knowledge that the drugs were there, control over the premises, and therefore would be in constructive possession of the drugs themselves and risk running afoul of the criminal provisions of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. Without it, there would be a risk of criminal prosecution. And needless to say, the province isn't going to set up a facility where they're asking their physicians and nurses and staff to run the risk of being criminally prosecuted. The Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, however, has an authority for the Minister of Health to allow for an exemption to the application of the criminal provisions. So Section 56 of the Act allows for the issuance of an exemption where it is necessary for medical or scientific purposes or otherwise in the public interest. And one of the interesting observations of the trial judge when the matter was first heard was that the initial authorization for Insight was provided for scientific purposes. Even though the application was sought for medical purposes or in the public interest, the authorization was in fact provided for scientific purposes. As I mentioned earlier, it was an experiment. It was to see if there would be positive results. And so the authorization that was provided on that basis. The structure of the Act with the prohibition and the discretionary authority to allow for an exemption turns out to be critical to the solution that the Supreme Court has in the case. Because what they say is that the prohibition, the blanket prohibition of the criminalization of these drugs, it puts at risk life, liberty, security of the person, but it does not infringe the principles of fundamental justice because of the possibility of providing an exemption. So the law itself is constitutional. It doesn't offend Section 7 because of the possibility, the discretionary authority for the minister to allow for an exemption. Of course, it could have been otherwise, right? And I think when I tell you that I don't think the decision has the precedential effect of ensuring that other sites could open, it's because instead of saying you can't possibly have this general prohibition without allowing for safe injection sites, they said you can have such a general prohibition as long as it's possible to exercise discretion to allow for some exceptions on a case-by-case basis. What they say, of course, is that the discretionary authority must be exercised in a manner that's consistent with the Charter. So in 2008, the federal government failed to extend Insight's exemption from the operation of the criminal laws, and this is what sent Insight to court and asked in a variety of different ways, in fact, and it's fortunate, I think, for people who are supportive of the outcome that they were so creative in first instance, because they said, first declare that the law doesn't apply to us under the circumstances. They also asked that the law be declared unconstitutional. They asked that the decision be declared unconstitutional. And they also asked that the court recognize, this is an aspect that I find particularly interesting and important, that the federal criminal law is inapplicable with respect to the province's exercise of their health care authorities. So they asked that the law found to be inapplicable on the basis of interjurisdictional immunity. And what the Supreme Court finds is that the minister's decision exercised under Section 56 to not authorize an exemption, but for the trial judge's interim order, would have prevented injection drug users from accessing the health services offered by Insight, threatening their health and indeed their lives. Based on the information available to the minister, I'm going to come back on that, that's very important. Based on the information available to the minister, this limit is not in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. And that's why we got the result that we got. The decision to not authorize Insight was found to be a violation of Section 7, and as a result, they were allowed to operate. I mentioned earlier that I'm particularly interested in the charter treatment, the charter review of administrative decisions, or the judicial review of administrative decisions that affect charter rights. The Supreme Court recently released a landmark decision 6 months after the decision in PHS in Doré versus the Barreau de Québec. I could talk about it for hours and hours and hours, but I'll just say this, that there was considerable controversy in the jurisprudence prior to the decision in Doré about how to approach a decision like the one in PHS, where the decision itself is purported to be the source of a violation of a charter right. And prior to that, the majority of the court in Multani, with a variety of different views expressed, said, you apply the Oaks test to it. You do it in the same way that you test the constitutional validity of the law. But in Doré, a unanimous court said, no, we will assess these decisions on the same basis that we assess all our administrative decisions. We'll evaluate them for the reasonableness of the decision. And to be fair to the court has told us that this new analytic framework, the reasonableness approach to reviewing an administrative decision that touches charter rights, will not be a less rigorous approach than what was demanded by Oaks. But I'll say from the point of view of a person who defends administrative decisions and defends laws on the basis of Section 1, that I'm much more comfortable and I feel I have more tools and more vocabulary defending a decision on the basis of reasonableness than on the strict requirements of Oaks. And I just, on this next slide, I line these up, right? We know the court has not told us that Section 1 isn't to be complied with. Of course, the fundamental law of Canada, the Charter has to be respected. Oak's test has traditionally been the way in which we test for compliance with Section 1. What Doré tells us is that an administrative decision now will be tested for reasonableness. And I want to look carefully at that because we say that reasonableness is a single standard that takes its color from its context, right? It's not more intense and more stringent reasonableness because a charter right is at stake or a more important right is at stake. The reviewing court cannot substitute their appreciation of the appropriate solution. The outcome must fall within the range of possible acceptable outcomes. The Supreme Court, I think, the Supreme Court reminds us that those two aspects of the reasonable test were already inside the Oaks test. They're already part of the minimal impairment. So when the court tells us that they're not making a lighter standard, there's a clear and credible basis for this, but I can't help but think that that when the next case comes around and we have a decision which is more nuanced, which is with a fuller record than the record that was before the minister in this case, where people who oppose the decision provide more evidence and where the minister takes the opportunity to express policy considerations that are ordinarily ones that are given a huge amount of deference by the court, that it'll be much more difficult for the court the next time round to say we think we need to intervene here. Because, and by the way, I think that's true as well, even if we did it under the Oaks test, a different record, a different decision, a different type of decision may produce a different result. And even within the decision itself, in PHS, the court uses precisely the kind of language that we're used to seeing when we know that they're going to show deference to a decision. It says, the issue of illegal drug use and addiction is a complex one, which attracts a variety of social and political, scientific, and moral reactions. There is room for disagreement between reasonable people concerning how addiction should be treated. It is for the relevant governments, not the court, to make criminal and health policy. However, when a policy is translated into law or state action, those laws and actions are subject to scrutiny under the Charter. The issue before the court at this point is not whether harm reduction or abstinence-based programs are the best approach to resolving illegal drug use. Now, as I say, I think we can imagine a different record before the decision maker. We can imagine a more nuanced decision which says, I've looked at these things, I have difficulty choosing between these options, but I, for policy reasons, I've chosen this approach rather than this approach. And we don't have very much history in, or we don't have very much jurisprudence in Canadian law of a court intervening in that kind of decision. And we see the classic hallmarks of a decision that the court will defer to. And my view is that the approach in Doré lends itself precisely to that outcome. And so I'm moving now to the second part of my remarks, and it's to say this. We have this terrible human and social problem that at least one level of government rushed in to try to address. And we have an ad hoc solution that is, in my view, in my reading of the case, applicable only to the facts of that case, and we don't know for certain what will happen when the next safe injection site asks for an exemption under Section 56. We don't know for sure. There's uncertainty, which surely, incidentally, has a chilling effect on parties who wish to on parties who would wish to implement a safe injection site, because they have to run the risk that they have to get caught up in an expensive legal battle because there's no certainty in the law. And which brings me to the second part of my remarks, which is to say the court had an opportunity to resolve the problem on the basis of interjurisdictional immunity, and they persisted on a trend that they've been on for the last 10 years of saying that, essentially saying, interjurisdictional immunity was a historical aberration and a mistake, and it exists where it's already been recognized, but we won't recognize it any further. And by the way, it's just bad luck that the only places it's ever been recognized is to protect federal authority and never for any provincial authorities. They didn't say that part. And perhaps as a tell you what I'm going to say about this, the court has said that interjurisdictional immunity, and I'm not necessarily supporting interjurisdictional immunity, my observation is more that interjurisdictional immunity was one solution. And the court told us, as they've told us in the past, that interjurisdictional immunity is antithetical to flexible cooperative federalism, right? Because it would allow unilateral action on the part of the level of government who enjoys the interjurisdictional immunity, no double aspect, etc. They're right, okay? The problem that I observe is that the exact same thing can be said of paramountcy. And what I'd like to persuade you in the last part of my remarks is that interjurisdictional immunity enjoys a much more credible foundation in the text of the Constitution, right, and what's actually written in Sections 91 and 92, than paramountcy does. And so as jurists and as citizens, when we look at this, I think we can say to the court that this approach is based on their policy choices about the way the Constitution ought to be interpreted. Paramountcy has no stronger basis than interjurisdictional immunity. In fact, I think if you go sit down and read the Constitution, you would think that interjurisdictional immunity is a much more credible approach. And as I said, I'm not necessarily saying they should have come back and adopted interjurisdictional immunity, but it seems to me that when you have this terrible human problem and you have a level of government who wants to actually address it, it cries out for the court to admit that there's something wrong with federalism when it can't be addressed by one level of government at all, right? It can't be addressed by one level of government at all. There's something wrong. And I would suggest to you that the court could look at the logic of 91-92 and use that primarily as their approach to solving division of powers problems. I'll give you a very, very quick constitutional refresher. I know that not everybody thinks about these things day in and day out and lies awake at night like me wondering about these things, but the very first step of a test when we're looking at whether or not a law is ultra vires or not is to do what the Supreme Court has very unhelpfully told, actually it's the House of Lords, unhelpfully described as the pith and substance analysis. Heureusement en français, le langage est beaucoup plus clair. On se demande la question, c'est quoi le caractère véritable du loi? What's the true character of this law, right? It's a lot more descriptive than pith and substance. I mean, I don't think I've ever used that sentence in my ordinary life. What's the pith and substance of that movie? So the court tells us to ask, what does the statute do and why does it do it? And then we answer that question and we're taught to answer the question without an eye to the lists of things in 91 and 92, without an eye to what are the enumerated powers, just to describe the law, what its true character is, and then ask whether that law falls into one of the enumerated heads of power. And importantly, in Canadian constitutional law, the courts have told us that it's possible that a law has a double aspect or an approach has a double aspect. So the easiest, I think, intuitively easiest example of that are prohibitions at the federal level and prohibitions at the provincial level against driving under the influence of alcohol. Federal looks at this and puts in place the identical provision. It's a criminal law purpose. That's what its matter is. And the province does it because it's a dangerous use of your property under property and civil rights, all the rules that they use about regulating driving on the roads, etc. So it's possible to have a double aspect. Double aspect, of course, is an important feature of Canadian federalism, but it produces a result. As soon as you recognize that you can have two laws operating in the same area, you need to also recognize that it's possible that they come into conflict with each other. And so there has to be a mechanism to resolve conflicts between laws and that are validly enacted under Section 91 and validly enacted under Section 92. This is, I would suggest to you, is not a... It's nothing about the Constitution. It's just a practical result. You can't have a situation where citizens can't comply with both laws or there's some kind of conflict. So the solution that the Supreme Court and indeed the House of Lords has proposed for Canadian constitutional law is paramountcy, federal paramountcy, which means that where there's a conflict, the federal law is the law that wins. It doesn't say that in the Constitution, okay? It doesn't say that at all. In fact, we're going to look closely at what the Constitution says. I don't want to say there's no basis whatsoever to believe that reading 91-92, but the basis is not particularly credible. There's certainly no basis for double aspect either, right? We're trying to interpret the Constitution in a way that's useful for our federation. That's fine that the court engages in that activity, but I think we need to recognize what aspects the courts have given us and what aspects are actually written in the Constitution Act 1867. The paramountcy doctrine, incidentally, operates at two possible levels. You can have the impossibility of complying. If you can't comply with both the federal and the provincial law, then you only comply with the federal one. And there's also a broader notion of this where you could have a frustration of the federal purpose. So you can imagine a federal law which is deliberately permissive and a provincial law which restricts the permission that the federal government has given, and you say, well, to comply with the provincial law frustrates the purpose of the federal law. And then, as a final possibility, not necessarily as a consequence of this, but if you don't have paramountcy, you can still have a situation where one law trumps another one, and it turns out that those are all federal laws that trump provincial laws. It's interjurisdictional immunity, where we recognize that the Constitution gave powers exclusively to the levels of government that they gave them to, and that those powers are exercised exclusively by that level of government. Now, up until Insight, what we knew for certain was that the court did not like interjurisdictional immunity. They told us in Canadian Western Bank that it went against the dominant tide of Canadian federalism, that it was against federal, that it was against flexible and cooperative federalism. And it had never yet been recognized to protect a provincial law from intrusion of federal statute. And so it was possible, and it was argued. So the British Columbia Court of Appeal recognized that Insight should operate on the basis of a protection from the federal criminal law, on the basis of interjurisdictional immunity. And they say, if the federal executive, in exercising or failing to exercise its authority, because it could simply not grant the exemption, right, granted by Parliament, can effectively prohibit a form of health care vital to the delivery of a provincial health care program, that means that Parliament has an effective veto over provincial health care services to the extent its use of the criminal law power can be justified by potential harm to public health or safety. And they go on to say, if interjurisdictional immunity is not available to a provincial undertaking on the facts of this case, then it may well be said that the doctrine is not reciprocal and can never be applied to protect exclusive provincial powers. I think that has to be right. The court reiterates in their analysis that they will not recognize any further instances of interjurisdictional immunity except for the ones that have already been recognized in the past. And so, you know, I once had a slide before I was trying to make this shorter of the occasions. They're all federal powers that have been recognized as having a core. Think about what that means. That means an area of jurisdiction where even if there's no conflict, a provincial government cannot go. In this case, what we were asking was the provincial government operating inside the core of one of their more important authorities and in a matter that was wholly local, and the court says that's a no-go. Interjurisdictional immunity will not be expanded. And as I said, okay, don't expand interjurisdictional immunity. It's problematic for double aspect, etc. But would it not invite the court to ask themselves if there isn't some other way, some new way to interpret these kinds of conflicts? And I suggest to you that it wouldn't require very much, right? It would require asking ourselves, what is the purpose, what's the logic of the division of powers? It looks like, maybe at first blush, just these practically random lists, 91 and 92. There's an absolutely beautiful paper written by law professor from the University of Toronto who died in the 1970s. Anyway, the paper is cited five times by the Supreme Court called The Neglected Logic of 91 and 92. And he says, Section 91 is the concerns of economists, and Section 92 is the concerns of sociologists. And we know, one thing that we know reading Sections 91 and 92 is we have the clear sense that 91 are about matters which are of central concern, that when you regulate, you're regulating them for all Canadians. And Section 92 are matters that are a local concern, that when you regulate, you affect the few people who are touched by the regulation at a merely local level. And when I said to you that neither federal paramountcy nor double aspect is written into the Constitution, and I said that interjurisdictional immunity actually enjoys a much stronger, much more credible basis in the text of the Constitution, I'm referring to this passage, which is the preamble of Section 91. So the Queen, on the advice and consent of Senate and the House of Commons, for the peace, order, and good government of Canada, may make laws in relation to all matters not coming within the classes of subjects by this act assigned exclusively to the legislatures of the province. So the general proposition is that Parliament has authority to do things that weren't assigned to the province. If you knew nothing about Canadian constitutional law, you had never taken a class in constitutional law, you read this and you looked at Insight, you would say, that's a health service. They have the authority to run and manage hospitals, which has always been interpreted as providing it. This was central and core to doing that. I don't need to know what's in Section 91 because I know that that list in Section 91 is provided for greater certainty about this proposition. And this proposition says that the things that are reserved for Parliament are the things that are not reserved for the provinces. That's the first catch-all. That's the general structure and why I structured it as a big circle, which is federal, with the circle for the provincial carved out of it, right? That's what the text of the Constitution says. And Section 92 has an important catch-all as well. It says that they will have generally all matters of a merely local or private nature within the province. That's 92.16. There's a clause at the end of 91 that says none of the enumerated things on the list shall be deemed to fall in 16. It's actually quite carefully drafted in that respect. So when I say that the Supreme Court is making a choice here, they're making a choice with federal paramountcy, they're making a choice with interjurisdictional immunity, the point is that when you look to the text of the Constitution, you see that at least interjurisdictional immunity enjoys some support in the Constitution, and the court could have said that they wanted to go there. And if they're not going to, because they follow a living tree doctrine, which I think is a rational and appropriate way of interpreting the Constitution, they could have at least have said these types of problems need to be resolved following the logic of the structure of 91 and 92. So I'm coming to the end of my remarks, and I want to, in thinking about these, say that the intense localness of the problem that we observed, right, is difficult to deny. Not only did they want the application of the provincial initiative in healthcare to apply within the province, but they wanted it only to apply within the four walls of the center, and it was to deliver a health service. We weren't talking about the criminal law not applying in the province of British Columbia. We were talking about in the delivery of a health service not committing a criminal act. The analysis could be otherwise, right? We could look at that case and say, in the conflict between these two laws, it is the delivery of the medical service which is more immediate, more following the logic of Section 92 than the application of the criminal law in this case. They could do something like that, and they've never given us any hint that they would do something in that manner. And the result is, in my submission, that we don't know now. We don't know whether a safe injection site is possible for other provinces. And not only do we not know, but I would be comfortable defending a decision that was nuanced and robust and saying that it falls within the minister's discretion. Section 56, Parliament gave the minister discretion to authorize or to not authorize an exemption of the criminal law. If it's done with a nuanced record and the reasons are take into consideration the evidence that were before them, and there's policy considerations that are taken into account, it strikes me as extremely difficult for the court to articulate a basis for intervening in that decision. And the result of that, when we think about it from a federalism point of view, is that nobody is genuinely accountable for this problem, right? We don't have, that's my main complaint, and maybe we'll talk about it in the questions, with cooperative federalism. If you have social initiatives, statutory initiatives that you want to advance, and they can only be accomplished through cooperation by federal and provincial governments, which is not something you would get from reading the text of the Constitution, if they can only be accomplished through cooperation, then nobody is genuinely accountable for them not ever happening. So with that, Véronique mentioned earlier that it is my father's 80th birthday. There he is. That beautiful little girl is me. I think we're ready for our break, right? Yeah. Is it a bit early? Wow, I was cut out all those slides. Should we? I always have more to say, but questions? Does that make sense, or should we go? If apparently we have more time, wow! How long did it take? Half. Oh. I'd be delighted to answer questions. No. The people surfing the web in the overflow room. There's lots of chairs here, by the way. Yes. I think that I'm going to invite Alana to jump in if I say something that's not right, but I think that it was absolutely not doubted that the PHS was a medical service, that they were addressing a health problem, and that they decided that the treatment that should be provided to the health problem was that a safe injection site that is attended by healthcare professionals would be a way of addressing that health problem.
That's true at all levels? All
courses? I think that's right. Yes, I don't think that. Otherwise, I don't think that the court, that would be a much simpler solution to the interjurisdictional immunity argument. They would just say, this isn't a health service, right? This isn't. I don't think so. Well, they don't inject them, right? They supervise their injection, so they're providing them they're providing them with a safe and sterile environment, and they're making sure that physicians and healthcare professionals are available to them in the event that they overdose. So the findings of fact with respect to the positive health results, it would be funny if you would have a hospital, right, deciding to do something to treat people, a finding of fact that there's a positive health result, and then the court saying, but that wasn't a health service. I mean, it's the health results, the finding of fact, once you read the decision in first instance, the finding of fact makes it almost a foregone conclusion. It was very positive results. Oh, yes. That's right. As I say, I don't know anything about the particular. You know, I don't know the record that was before the minister in any manner. But that's what the trial judge remarks. I didn't see any document, but the trial judge makes that observation, and he says the degree to which this discretion is unfettered is evidenced by the fact that even though the application was made on the basis of health and arguing the health benefits, the authorization was provided, the label was on scientific basis. So we don't know whether, you know, sometimes judges, as I'm sure you all know, will pick up on something that maybe it was not pleaded, maybe it wasn't intentional on the part of the Minister of Health at the time to do that. They used some form because the other authorizations had all been scientific studies. I have no idea, but it is interesting to observe that that was the basis.
So a perfect
analysis. I tried that. Right. Well, I think. When you look to the findings of fact, that is somewhat the approach that the Minister of Health at the time took. He said, okay, we'd like to study this further. We've got these results. And by the way, it was contested in trial how successful it was. And the trial judge remarks with the evidence before him that it's actually difficult to figure out whether the federal government brought evidence to criticize the success of it. But the findings of fact are that the passage that I put there was from the Supreme Court. I should have put the cite. They said it saved lives and improved health. So, but you're absolutely right, and I think that was part of the approach of the minister to say, okay, we've got that data now. Let's think about other approaches to this problem. And I think Part of the difficulty, as I understand, I've scoured the facts in first instance to try to figure it out, and I didn't want to sort of pollute myself by asking people in, from the Attorney General who were involved in the case. But what appears to have been have happened was that the initial authorization was provided in 2003 for a three-year period. It was extended for 1 year during the minority government of the Conservatives, and then an additional 6 months with members of the government party suggesting that it wouldn't be authorized and no decision being taken. I'm looking to people who know no news and no decision being taken saying that they wanted to study the matter further, right? So we don't have, you know, I'm in a practice in administrative law, and what I'm used to is that when a decision is finally taken, that we would have a record that was in front of the decision maker and the decision maker's reasons. But what happened here, partly because of the way in which the application was brought to the court, and partly because I believe no decision was taken, and in fact, there is some media that says that at the Supreme Court, Rob Frater, who pleaded the case, said to the court, there still hasn't been a decision on this, right? And he gets criticized by the court for saying that. But normally, and that's why I emphasize that the next time, if there's a record before the decision maker, and there's a decision, and that record is balanced, right? There's going to be people who are against this. They may not have as solid scientific evidence. That's the suggestion of the court that it'll be difficult. But they may bring other considerations. And you'll see in Alana's presentation, there's a quote from a video, actually, of the health minister at the time. And I'm not going to adopt his remarks as my own at all, but he expresses a purely political point of view about a safe injection site, purely political. And we know that when Parliament gives discretionary authority to a minister to make a decision, taking into consideration a political view is appropriate and usually an area where the court is not supposed to intervene. And if that was all expressed in a decision that was brought to the court and reviewed like an ordinary judicial review application, my view is that it would be much more difficult for the court to intervene. What's extraordinary about the decision in Doré, it certainly doesn't add anything to Dunsmuir. Well, there's one aspect that I think it nuances Dunsmuir. But in Doré, we have the court reversing itself from Molteni. Molteni, the court is divided. We have three different decisions. How do we analyze the constitutionality of an administrative decision? And the majority in Molteni said Oakes. You look for the pressing and substantial objective. You ask yourself whether there's a rational connection, minimally impair, and you balance. That's the majority decision in Molteni. There's a powerful dissent from Deschamps and Abella saying, no, Oakes shouldn't be applied to individual decisions. It should only be applied to laws. And in Doré, a unanimous court adopts that view and says, you're not going to apply Oakes, you're going to apply the reasonableness test. And they apply the test in Dunsmuir. But the only thing that's nuanced about Dunsmuir is that Dunsmuir told us that there's a presumption that the standard of review for constitutional decisions is correctness, and they have changed that now. The court doesn't say we're changing that aspect of Dunsmuir. They say, of course, in Dunsmuir we said that it's correctness. That still applies when you're analyzing a decision that challenges the constitutionality of a law, but on an individual decision which is said to infringe a charter right, like in Doré, right, restricting Maître Doré's freedom of expression, or in PHS, a decision, right, which will refuse to provide an exemption to people who will otherwise have their Section 7 rights at stake, they say, don't do Oakes, do the reasonable analysis. So it doesn't change what the reasonable analysis is. It just applies the reasonable analysis to the reasonableness standard of review to a decision which infringes charter rights, which up until now we had most of the jurisprudence said apply Oakes to that. That's it.
Okay. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So we will now take a break and ask you to come back at 7:25 for the second presentation.
Lana, you want to see if it just works?
Sure.
I don't know, Prezi.
I know, and I don't feel, I feel like it's an anxiety provoker for people.
Oh, for me, I would be so anxious. Well, that doesn't tell you whether it works.
Oh, yeah, it works.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I mean, it's not that much margin for error, really. I know it's hard to imagine that because it's so
scary.
Not PowerPoint.
Nope, not PowerPoint. But you know, Alex was literally, you could have done his in a PowerPoint.
He
was almost used it as a PowerPoint.
Yeah.
He did a Prezi PowerPoint.
Yeah, mine is a bit like that too, but it's got
well, except you have some fun things in the back.
Yeah.
Mind you can do that in a PowerPoint.
Sure, you can.
I'm giving a PowerPoint in Princeton if I ever go. And I have lots of fun things in my background.
Yeah,
colors
yeah.
And
mine has a video embedded, so that's a bit different.
Yeah, you can do that. You just embed the link.
Yeah, but you don't have to press play. You just keep playing. I know. And then you go
down.
Back and forth, and you can see where on the thing it goes.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But it's not. But in fact, I think I used it almost as a slide.
Well,
as a PowerPoint too.
Alex really. But he was good. Yeah, I just filled up cold water. I'd invite you all to take your seats, please. Can you take your seats, please? Thank you so much. Welcome back. I hope you've had a nice break. And I'm sure that the first part of the evening piqued your interest, and I assure you that there's more good stuff to come. I'd like now to introduce our second speaker, Professor Alana Klein, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce her to you. Professor Klein is a graduate of our Faculty of Law, where she obtained her BCL and LLB degrees in 2002. After clerking for former Justice Louise Arbour at the Supreme Court of Canada and becoming a member of the Law Society of Upper Canada, she went on to pursue graduate studies in law at Columbia University, where she obtained LLM and JSD degrees. Professor Klein, who joined the Faculty of Law in 2008, teaches and researches in a wide array of very interesting areas. In fact, I'm always telling her how lucky she is because she deals with such juicy and interesting cases that range from criminal law and criminal procedure, health law, and human rights law. And in particular, she teaches a very popular and interesting course on law and poverty. Prior to joining the faculty, Professor Klein was a senior policy analyst with the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. She has also taught at Columbia Law School and Columbia University, and she was appointed to the Ontario Human Rights Commission in 2006. This is not Professor Klein's first appearance at Formation Continue. Last year, she gave a great talk on the Conservative government's omnibus crime bill, and the audience saw why she has won the John W. Durnford Teaching Excellence Award in 2010. Please welcome Alana Klein, who will discuss the case from a different perspective, that namely of Section 7.
Hot. I'm going to take some water. So although the argument on jurisdiction, which my friend and colleague Alex would have been happy to have seen get more attention, was rejected at the Supreme Court of Canada, the court did ultimately and very famously rule that shutting down Insight violated the charter rights of Insight clients and Insight staff. It's a remarkable decision. The court held that the criminal law could not interfere with the provincially established site on the basis, very broadly speaking, and I'll get into the details in a little bit, but on the basis that the criminal law couldn't prevent people who use drugs from accessing potentially life-saving treatment where the province was providing that life-saving treatment. And I say very broadly because then I'll tell you all the ways in which the decision might have been interpreted or might come to be interpreted more narrowly. But still, I want to impress upon you how significant it is, and this is really the first time that the Supreme Court has done this, has said that the criminal law can't prevent people from accessing this potentially life-saving treatment. And the case, as you probably remember, made headlines. So I clipped a few of them. And one of the reasons why it made headlines was really its potentially expansive reach. We've already begun asking the question of whether this would open the door to more safe injection sites across Canada. I think in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. But I should tell you that the decision, being based on Section 7 of the Charter, actually had the potential, and still has the potential, I think, to be even broader than that. That is, it can have implications beyond simply safe injection sites and toward places where the criminal law interferes with health-seeking behavior in other areas. And I should tell you that Section 7 of the Charter has the potential to be very expansive indeed, and this is particularly so in relation to health and the criminal law. Of course, it's well known... it's well known that any law that creates a risk of imprisonment actually engages your security of the person, right? So that means that any criminal law engages your security of the person. On top of it, so much of the criminal law, and I know this as a scholar in health who does work in sort of health and in criminal law, so much of the criminal law is really not especially good for your health. It's not. In fact, it's very difficult to show in general that the criminal law actually does an especially good job at protecting health and safety, particularly of those people who are subjected to the criminal law. This is most obviously true in harm reduction. And I just added this slide today because I realized as I was talking to this group that you may, you know, even though Jean-Francois did explain some of the important things that happen in harm reduction, you may not really know what harm reduction is. And this is a decision that's really about harm reduction. Harm reduction is defined in various ways in different places, but one way of defining it is harm reduction policies are programs that are designed to reduce drug-related harm without necessarily reducing drug use per se. And so they're based on the idea that many of the harms associated with drug use don't necessarily come from the use of the drugs themselves, but from the surrounding circumstances that people who use drugs find themselves in. I also found another definition that came from the City of Vancouver's website, which I think maybe explains it even better and, you know, explains harm reduction as a philosophy even better. Do no harm to those suffering from substance addiction. Focus on the harms caused by problematic substance use rather than the substance use per se. And Vancouver's site also adds, but I didn't want to overload this slide, that harm reduction involves usually establishing a hierarchy of achievable goals for a person who's suffering from addiction, a hierarchy of achievable goals that, taken step by step, can lead to a healthier life for those people and a healthier community for everyone. And it accepts that abstinence is not necessarily a realistic goal for everyone, especially in the short term. And I think any of you who've ever tried to quit smoking probably know about that. You probably tried multiple times before you actually managed to quit smoking. Maybe you haven't managed to quit smoking at all, and maybe you just try to cut down. Well, that's the essence of what a harm reduction approach would suggest. And for injection drugs, of course, that's true. Many, as Jean-Francois suggested, many of the harms associated with injection drug use come from ways in which drugs are used. Shared needles, for example, when there's a scarcity of fresh sterile needles, which can lead to transmission of HIV and hepatitis C. Dull needles leading to abscess and infection. And drug seeking that also, because drugs are illegal, can interfere with things like employment. And so there are a number of examples of harm reduction programs. Some of them relate to drugs in particular, and they're more familiar to you, or they may be more familiar to you. And they include things like needle exchange programs, which oftentimes don't amount to a one-for-one exchange, but really are about the best methods of needle distribution and the best methods of needle recuperation. That may not necessarily be one-for-one exchange. The goal is always to maximize health. So maybe one thing that you could understand as characterizing harm reduction is that it's intensely pragmatic. It's mostly interested in whatever works to maximize health outcomes. Other examples of harm reduction programs include prescription heroin trials, which we've had in Montreal and which have been helpful in improving health outcomes and improving employment for people who use heroin. And if it also helps, I gave you the smoking example, but you might also draw a parallel with safer sex. Instead of urging you to stop having sex altogether, or maybe only for procreation, we might suggest that you might use condoms, either as an alternative to or in addition to abstinence, depending on whether you're someone for whom total abstinence from sex works. For some people that works. Now, the point is that the criminal law, notoriously blunt instrument that it is, sits rather poorly with these harm reduction approaches, and is even known to interfere with them. Clearly, folks will be afraid to use a needle exchange program if, for example, possession of needles with trace amounts of illegal drugs in them can get you convicted for drug possession, which, as we learned today from Alex to some extent, drug possession laws are very, very broadly cast, and indeed, on the letter of the law, you could be found in possession of drugs for bringing in, even though you're doing the right thing and being a good citizen, bringing in a syringe with trace amounts of drugs in it. Moreover, many policies within jails leave people vulnerable to assault or to diseases including HIV and hepatitis C. And finally, and here's another example, there's a case that's going up to the Supreme Court now for which leave was just granted last Thursday, which talks about the ways in which the criminalization of sex work interferes with the health and safety of sex workers. My point is not necessarily that all criminal law that negatively affects health should be unconstitutional. Maybe it should, and some people might argue that, and I wouldn't want to stifle their creative energies. I think that that's an interesting conversation to have and a good conversation to have. My point is really rather that you can imagine that given the potential conflict between the criminal law in general and health, that courts would approach this kind of question with some caution. And indeed, that's what happened in this case. What's interesting is that it did so with great caution, but really rather quickly and rather laconically. In only 56 short paragraphs, and we all know, since we're all lawyers here, that the Supreme Court of Canada rarely expresses an important opinion in 56 short paragraphs, the court determined that the government had violated Section 7 in this case. But it was very careful in my mind to frame the direction, the decision, narrowly, leaving open some big questions for the many ways in which government actions linked to negative health outcomes might be treated in the future. So let's look for a moment at exactly what the court determined in its unanimous Section 7 decision. First of all, as I said, you'll recall that Section 7 is engaged every time there's a threat of criminal sanction, that is the Section 7 liberty interests. Anytime you might go to jail, Section 7 liberty interests are triggered, and the question then becomes, is this limitation on your liberty right in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice, right? And so it was kind of a quick and easy one for the court to conclude that the liberty interests of InSight staff are engaged by the threat of imprisonment for drug possession, because as we talked about, drug possession is construed so broadly that if you know that someone has drugs on the premises and that you have control over that person's premises on the presence, that can constitute possession. Maybe you didn't know that. Good to think about. In any event, the court came to that conclusion rather quickly. To me, the more interesting, from a precedential point of view, perspective was engagement of the Section 7 right came from the Section 7 rights of InSight clients. And here the court found that the rights of InSight clients, not just the rights to liberty because they risk criminal sanction, but also their rights to life and security of the person, were engaged by, of course, the threat of imprisonment, but also by denial of access to health services provided by InSight. And this is very important. Of course, the question then becomes, does this deprivation of life, liberty, and security of the person accord with those principles of fundamental justice? And here we see something of a bit of a sleight of hand, I would say, on the part of... on the part of the court when it determined how to consider whether this deprivation was in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. Here, instead of finding, as the claimants had asked, that the drug laws themselves violated the principles of fundamental justice, the court engaged in really what I think is kind of an interesting sleight of hand that Alex mentioned. The problem wasn't the possession law itself, the court said, because the possession law is flexible. And so the court said the constitutional validity of Section 4 can't be determined without considering this safety valve, which is Section 56 of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. I should mention also that Section 55 of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act allows cabinet to make regulations allowing for the distribution of controlled substances for medical, scientific, and industrial applications. This makes sense. If you break your leg, you'll need your prescriptions. And in addition, this is the provision under which the federal government has issued regulations for access to medical marijuana. So that was Section 55. And that's for cabinets. Section 56, which is the one at issue, the provision at issue here, is about the Minister of Health's permission to grant or option to grant exemptions. The problem is the minister here passed once the Conservative government was elected. A number of years into Insight's mandate, wasn't especially inclined to help. Is exactly what happened. Right. But of course, he knew that. And really, without going into detail, this does give you a bit of a sense of the Minister of Health's receptiveness to keeping Insight going. And you should know that our current Minister of Justice, Leona Aglukkaq, is really no more receptive. She recently attracted some criticism for refusing to sign the Vienna Declaration on Drug Policy, which had been signed by a number of countries in which Canada would have been expected to sign, on the basis that, essentially on the basis that harm reduction is in conflict with Canada's tough on crime agenda. That's my sleight of hand. And so here what the court said was, yes, absolutely, the exemption in this case should have been granted on the facts. It wasn't. And so here's where we get to the essence of the question of how the Supreme Court made its decision. Why was the refusal to issue this exemption a violation of Section 7 of the Charter? That is, why did that refusal violate the principles of fundamental justice? And here the court said, well, it's one of the principles of fundamental justice that a law can't be arbitrary, overbroad, or grossly disproportionate. Now, this is something, I don't know how long ago you've been, you last studied Section 7. Of course, we always get a wide variety of people who are here, who come to Formation Continue. But this idea that laws can't be overbroad, arbitrary, or disproportionate is one that has its seeds in some earlier cases, but that's recently really come to a head and started to get a little bit more attention in this case, in the prostitution case that I talk about. That I mentioned, and also in a couple of recent decisions that I'm going to mention today. But it's interesting that a law that limits your rights to life, liberty, and security of the person in order to adhere to the principles of fundamental justice has to not be arbitrary. And what that means is that that law, or that action as it is in this case, has to be proportionate. That is, it has the law has to do what it says it's going to do. That's really what how arbitrariness has been understood so far. So the court has said, in order to determine whether a law is arbitrary, look at the relationship between the law's objectives on the one hand and the law's effects on the other hand. It's interesting that suddenly, I mean, for so many years, criminal law has not had a burden of needing to do what it says it's going to do. And so it's interesting to see, you know, we haven't really verified as a constitutional matter whether criminal law is achieving its objectives. So it's interesting to see this arbitrariness analysis brought to the criminal law. And here, the court determines that the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act's purpose is the protection of health and safety. Some people might argue that it has a different purpose. But the court accepted in this case that the purpose of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act was the protection of health and safety. Once you decide that that's what our drug law is for, protecting health and safety, it's not that hard to find that the effect of the exemption denial is to undermine that purpose. And that's exactly what the court found. The court found that the criminal prohibition had done little to reduce drug use in the downtown East Side. And again, I'll hold my essay later. The court also found that the risk of death and disease is reduced when clients inject under the supervision of a health professional, which I think that video was probably pretty good at demonstrating to you. It might have been hard to look at, but it's easier to imagine that if that has to happen, it should happen with medical professionals around. And what's interesting, and I think that this is part of what makes it, what's going to make it hard for what might be an obstacle to some of the expansive interpretations of this case that some people might be imagining is that the court found that in this circumstance, the presence of insight did not contribute to crime, public injection, or relapse rates. And what was interesting was that the court even had some comments from, for example, the Chinese Business Association in the neighborhood, which had supported insight. Part of the reason why it had supported insight was, I think, because the rates of public injection and the perception of public injection had been very high, which might not necessarily be the case in other places. So we'll get to that. Importantly, and I put this in red, the staff had intervened in 336 overdoses since 2006, and not a single overdose had occurred at the facility. So when the court says insight had saved lives, they mean that very literally. And I should mention that for very similar reasons, but the court talked about this so briefly I didn't even bother putting it on a slide, the court determined that the refusal was also grossly disproportionate. It was grossly disproportionate because the refusal of the exemption prevented insight from working. Insight saves lives. The benefits have been proven, the court said. There's no discernible negative impact on the public health and safety objectives that come from insight. Now, you might have two lingering questions, and I anticipated them here as I move on from describing the case to you. The first is, well, what if there had been no Section 56 exemption provision? It's an important question because I told you criminal law is often not good for your health, and frequently there is no similar exemption contained in the legislation like Section 56. And so the court here was rather cagey. It said, if the Act consisted solely of blanket prohibitions with no exemptions for necessary medical and scientific uses, the assertions that the possession prohibition is arbitrary, overbroad, and disproportionate in its effects might gain some traction. And indeed, in, for example, the prostitution case that's coming up to the Supreme Court in the next number of months, there is no similar exemption, nor would that exemption really be effective. And I'll tell you a bit why about that later. Now, the other question that was addressed in the case that I think is worth noting is the question of whether, and I think, we got a sense that this might have been something that was considered by some of the earlier questions that you were talking about, that you were asking, Alex, don't health risks come from the choice of people who use injection drugs? This is very important because a lot of the time you're going to hear similar arguments raised in other cases, right? Which is, sure, the criminal law has negative health impacts, but don't do anything criminal and there won't be any negative health impacts, right? So in this particular case, the court says, well, addiction is an illness characterized by the loss of control over the need to consume. So you may not find, that was part of the thing that might eventually keep this decision narrow. We'll talk about that in a minute. In fact, we'll talk about that right now. So the question is, is PHS a narrow decision? And I think in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. In some ways, it was grounded very closely to the facts of this particular situation. First of all, there was evidence that criminal prohibitions were not working to protect health and safety. Part of that comes from the fact that the downtown East Side is a place where the effects of criminal prohibitions are being measured very carefully. It's an area that receives a tremendous amount of scientific inquiry, and there are, in fact, entire institutes in Vancouver whose job is primarily to examine the effects of health and social policy on these marginalized communities in Vancouver's downtown East Side. There were facts which Alexander alluded to as well about the growing public health crisis in Vancouver's downtown East Side. Between 1987 and 1993, the number of overdose deaths went from 16 per year to 200 per year. 200 overdose deaths per year. HIV and hepatitis C epidemics were reported in 1996, and in 1997, a public health emergency was declared. So that was what was going on in the downtown east side before Insight began its work. And then Insight, by contrast, had been very well studied and demonstrated the facts, as the court found them in the case, were that the trial judge found them in the case, were that it had intervened in 336 overdoses, as I mentioned. The other thing was, and this was mentioned in the video, it was found through scientific studies to have actually encouraged people to seek counseling, detox, and treatment at rates higher than the criminal prohibition had managed to do. And in addition, there were no negative impacts on crime rates, incidents of public injection, and relapse rates. Part of the reason why, sorry, I'm not the best at Prezi, it turns out. Part of the reason why was because this is indeed such a well, why this evidence was so available was because this was such a well-studied area. And here I just did a Google search, Google Scholar search. It's not a Google search, but a Google Scholar search. I don't know how many of you use it, but that's where you find scientific articles. This is not a very scientific way of researching it because, of course, a lot of things are going to pop up on Google Scholar that may just be citations to other you know, scientific papers. But nonetheless, you can see that there are about 16,400 results, which gives you some sense of the number of scientific studies that might have been undertaken in Vancouver's downtown east side. Other reasons why that I wanted to mention why this is also could be considered a narrow decision. Yeah, I did that on purpose. thank you. Other reasons I think why this can be considered a narrow decision was that the court narrowed its decision in a way by focusing on this ministerial exemption. As I mentioned, for criminal offenses that have been, for many criminal offenses that have been shown in research to generate negative health impacts, things like sex work, polygamy is another example that one of my colleagues studies, this decision doesn't reveal much because there's no such exemption available. Moreover, and this is the point that I wanted to make here, not all circumstances lend themselves to a Section 56 exemption process. Right. So, for example, neighborhood crackdowns on drugs have been shown to interfere with people's access to counseling, drug treatment, and needle exchange. But this is hardly something that could be addressed through a Section 56 exemption. It's the ordinary, you can't apply for an exemption from drug crackdowns in the neighborhood. Right. You apply for exemptions for particular medical facilities and circumstances, in particular circumstances. I also wanted to add that much of the evidence that was gathered and that was relied upon here was gathered during the period when, of course, Insight benefited from the exemption, right? Other safe injection sites operating in Canada now, maybe right now, or that might choose to operate, don't do this with the benefit of an exemption. And if you don't do it with the benefit of an exemption, chances are there's going to be a chilling effect on scientific research that might be undertaken. Certainly, you're not going to have entire institutes within universities devoted to studying the impacts. And so there was some risk that on the facts, this could be, as I said, a narrow decision. And I think that that's true. However, I think that Insight does actually represent a doctrinal expansion. That is, I think that it expands the power of Section 7, or at least reveals an expansion of the power of Section 7 to address places where the criminal law interferes with people's health-seeking behavior. The court, as I said, was pretty laconic on arbitrariness and gross disproportionality. As it said, Insight was working and the criminal law wasn't. That was basically the court's approach. And yet, I think that these few words masked a move that's really quite remarkable. First of all, the court showed no deference at all to a decision that was, on the face of it, a discretionary one. Right? If you look at Section 56, it looks entirely discretionary. We're still trying to work out what this means for future charter challenges, and I think that Alex and I might have a lot to talk about there for discretionary decision-making. I'm thinking particularly of negative impact, how many potential negative impacts of criminal law are avoided, for example, simply through the use of police and prosecutor discretion. Jean-François and Louis can talk about the ways in which some of those negative health impacts might have been facilitated at various times, depending on how things work with your good relationships with police officers, right? The police officers might decide they're going to forbear from bringing criminal charges that might interfere with the work that an organization like CACTUS does. Will courts look more closely at that discretion right now? I very much doubt it. I very much doubt that courts are going to get involved in looking closely into police and prosecutor discretion. But they might. Second, and this is something that I wanted to focus more closely on, the court did, this is the to me, what I think is really one of the most important features of this, why I say that this is a doctrinal expansion for Section 7. I think that the court did a far more searching review of the facts supporting the decision than I had expected based on what I knew about the arbitrariness analysis before. So I'm thinking in particular of a case called Malmo-Levine. Does anyone remember this one? So Malmo-Levine, this case was actually, it was while I was doing my clerkship, and Mr. Malmo-Levine was a self-represented recreational marijuana user who challenged the marijuana laws at the Supreme Court, and there you see him protesting with a giant, what appears to be a giant, actually smoking joint in his hands. I wasn't there for that, it was actually tremendous to watch him represent himself at the Supreme Court. And you know what? He did a pretty good job, but not good enough. The court found against him. It felt that the prohibition on marijuana was, it said, the court said, is not arbitrary. So that's where the court really picked up on this arbitrariness analysis and expanded on it for the first time. It said the prohibition is not arbitrary, but is rationally connected to a reasonable apprehension of harm. Criminalization seeks to take marijuana out of the hands of users and potential users so as to prevent the associated harm and to eliminate the market for traffickers. Therefore, it cannot be said that the prohibition is arbitrary. The wisdom of the prohibition, Parliament might reconsider, but the prohibition is not arbitrary. Look at the language that the court uses here. It's rationally connected to a reasonable apprehension of harm. The court's not asking whether, in fact, smoking marijuana whether it actually creates harm or whether criminalization is in fact achieving objectives related to health and safety. All it's saying is one could rationally imagine that the marijuana prohibition could prevent the use of marijuana. And that's good enough, even if there are secondary negative effects. So it really had a notion of arbitrariness. Excuse me. It had a notion of arbitrariness that was really very theoretical. Something's arbitrary if it has no, if it bears no relationship to its objectives. That was 2003. That same year, though, I'll mention that in a moment. And I think that there, what we really saw was a court being deferential to government policies on marijuana. And you might have expected the same from this decision, too, because the court indicates, just as Alex said, that this might be an occasion for deference. At paragraph 105 in the PHS decision, the court says the issue of illegal drug use and addiction is a complex one which attracts a variety of social, political, scientific, and moral reactions. There's room for disagreement. It's for governments, not the court, to make criminal health policy, criminal and health policy. Now, of course, Malmo-Levine is, as the recreational pot smoker, is very different from your typical client at Insight, whose health can be fairly said to be in crisis. But still, the court in Malmo-Levine was not interested in looking too closely at whether the marijuana prohibition was doing what it claimed to be doing. The court was not interested in looking very closely at that. So here, when the court said that we're going to look beyond the notional relationship between the criminal law and its impacts and actually look at the facts, it's a big change. The war on drugs mentality, as I mentioned, is not one that's really based all that closely on evidence as to its effectiveness, particularly in relation to addictions research. Harm reduction, on the other hand, is one of those areas of health policy that is especially well-researched and well-grounded in scientific research, as I think I've suggested previously. So I think that opening up the expansion, opening up Section 7 arbitrariness and disproportionality analysis to look at the effects of criminal prohibitions in the real world is really important and a really good idea. On the other hand, this opens up a big can of, I wouldn't want to say worms, because I don't really think it's a can of bad things. I think it's a can of good things. That is, I think it gives us an opportunity to look at, from a constitutional perspective, whether laws that inhibit our health and inhibit our freedom are really effective and are really doing what they want to do. But of course, it creates a set of problems. The obvious one is the one that's raised or addressed or alluded to in this quotation, which is that it creates a question of boundaries, of the role of courts, and of evidence. And of course, this is exactly what the court in PHS alluded to. And some of you might be worried. I can imagine that some of you in the room are worried that you say, well, look, you know, here's this opportunity that the court takes to weigh in on harm reduction, even though it claimed that it wasn't weighing in on harm reduction. Here's this, the court did take this opportunity to weigh in on harm reduction, to favor harm reduction. This is really a policy decision. This isn't the kind of decision that courts ought to be taking. And the court in PHS was alive to that concern. Now, of course, this wasn't the first time that the courts have looked at in determining whether a particular law or policy violates Section 7. This was not the first time that the court looked at the actual relationship between a law and its effects. You might remember this case. Do you remember that guy? This is the Shaouli decision, which was also a 2003 decision, where the court applied the very same arbitrariness analysis. It said that our laws that restrict security of the person, in this case a prohibition, if you recall, on obtaining private health insurance for publicly insured services, the case is a little bit complicated because it ended up being decided on the Quebec Charter, but effectively the majority of the court found that the prohibition on obtaining private health insurance for publicly insured services, which by the government was justified as a way of avoiding a completely parallel private health system that would only serve the wealthy to leave the ordinary health system increasingly burdened and serving poorer and poorer populations, the court said that prohibition on private health insurance was arbitrary. That's effectively what the court ended up deciding. Of course, it divided 3-3 on the charter issue, but based on the Quebec Charter, it determined that this prohibition was arbitrary. Now, of course, if you look at it, you think, well, you know what? It's reasonable to expect that prohibiting private insurance might protect the public health system. That's a reasonable thing to expect. And so if it had been decided on the Malmö-Levin standard, right, then you might have said, you know what, this is upheld because this is not an arbitrary law. It's a law that has some, one could imagine that it could actually achieve what it says it's going to achieve. No, the court says. The task of the courts is to evaluate the issue in light not just of common sense or theory, but of the evidence. So to me, this is, but as I said, in the Shaouli case, the court was divided 3-3 on the Canadian Charter, and so its decision hadn't yet been taken up. But this really represents the court taking up this view in Shaouli. Now, many people think that the court's understanding of the role of private health insurance in Shaouli was wrong. In fact, it's attracted quite a lot of criticism of people who've said, you know what, the court got it wrong, even on the evidence. Outlawing private insurance protects the public health system. A lot of people came out and said that after the case. And so they say, well, look here, this is a perfect example of when you invite the court to establish, to understand arbitrariness with a view to the facts. It looks to understand arbitrariness with a view to the facts, and it gets it all wrong. I understand, but I don't think that that's a reason for courts not to evaluate the real-world impact of the laws that it passes. Right? Yes, the court might get it wrong sometimes. There was a big outcry after Shaouli, and you know what? After there was that big outcry, after the Shaouli case, after that big outcry, the court, the legislator rather, decided to interpret Shaouli and the precedent created by Shaouli rather narrowly. So it's important to think about the context in which decisions are taken and understood. So I would, in conclusion on that part, I just want to say that I would welcome the idea that if a criminal law has perverse effects on health, life, safety, and security, it ought to be a candidate for unconstitutionality. I do believe that. If our worry is the capacity and legitimacy of judicial intervention, that is, if we're worried that courts are biting off more than they can chew here, then I think that courts should consider their own capacity and the legitimacy of their own intervention directly when they decide to intervene. What do I mean by that? Well, here the court was of the view that the evidence in favor of Insight was so strong. And I've mentioned before that the evidence is not likely to be as strong in other circumstances. But one thing that I think that the Supreme Court ignored in this case, one thing that I think it could have attended to in support of its decision, was the fact that Insight enjoyed what I think is enhanced democratic legitimacy. What I mean by that, and I think Alex set this out in some detail, I think that Insight was created through, I know that Insight was created through the collaboration of provincial authorities, municipal authorities, and in fact, what's interesting is that the provincial government had decided to devolve decision-making authority about what kinds of health services to provide to municipal authorities for a specific reason, basically on the basis that those municipal authorities are going to be better at serving the local needs of their local communities than provincial authorities would. And it was through that devolution to local municipal authorities of some health decision-making that, or regional health authorities, it was through that devolution to regional health authorities that the Vancouver Regional Health Authority ended up creating the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. The Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users ended up helping to establish and come up with this idea of creating this safe injection site. So in other words, I contrast this decision with Shaouli. In Shaouli, what the court was doing was it was weighing some perceived state of nature, which is the freedom to obtain private health insurance, against a provincially created law. A democratically created law. Here, what the court is weighing is different. It's weighing a federally created law, which has the same democratic legitimacy as the provincially created law within its framework, against another democratically created option. And so my argument is that weighing in support of this other democratically created option is more legitimate than it would have been if this had not been something that was created through democratic channels. And so maybe it's easier to understand my point, and I realize, you know, I'm pitching it to you, but it's certainly nothing that the court ever said in this decision, but I think it's important. Remember that the court said the issue of illegal drug use is complex. There's room for disagreement. It's for relevant governments and not courts to make criminal and health policy. Well, here, relevant governments did make health policy. And the court never really alludes to that. I think it drove the court in some way, because otherwise, why would there have been that big, long discussion in glowing terms about cooperative federalism in the early parts of the decision? Now, this might all sound very academic to you, possibly in the pejorative sense of the term, I accept that. I'm used to that. But this has some practical implications. It really does. First, in my mind, I think it means that other harm reduction efforts, particularly those that come through grassroots work in marginalized communities and that manage to gain some support from our democratic institutions, should not have to jump as high as Insight did on the facts. These grassroots efforts serve a community that's not really represented especially well in democratic politics, and I think, again, I know you might disagree with me, that that ought to be taken into account when the court determines how much deference it's going to grant to governments on a Section 7 analysis. It also would mean that provincial efforts, and I think that in this way I seek the same kind of result that Alex sought, I think it also means that provincial efforts to mitigate health and safety-related harms of criminal justice, things like youth courts, Aboriginal sentencing, harm reduction, should be constitutionally favored in challenges to health-affecting federal laws because they represent some form of democratic will. And so the court should recognize that it owes less deference to the federal government in those kinds of circumstances. Also, last time I spoke with you, I talked to you a little bit about how the federal government's recently passed crime bill is expected to generate a number of constitutional challenges in relation to mandatory minimum sentences, prison conditions, and the disparate impact of amendments on Aboriginal people and people requiring mental health care. Quebec Minister of Justice Jean-Marc Fournier has announced his intention to do everything he can to soften the impact of Bill C-10 in Quebec. That, if you recall, is the new tough-on-crime bill. My argument is that with this decision, the Charter may potentially prove to be a useful tool, even more useful tool in that regard than he had thought. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Alana. That was really interesting. And what I'd like to do now is, je voudrais inviter maintenant Jean-François Marie de reprendre la parole et de nous parler sur l'impact de la décision sur Insight, sur son travail.
Avant de commencer sur l'impact, je voudrais revenir sur les pouvoirs discrétionnaires qui sont exercés présentement. On est encore dans une zone grise de la loi, sans même qu'il y ait des traces de substances dans les seringues. La paraphernalia, au sens strict du code criminel, est illégale. Donc les seringues qu'on distribue, les pipes à crack qu'on distribue, sont illégales au sens du code criminel, et d'autant plus quand il y a des traces de drogue à l'intérieur, parce que la substance elle-même est aussi présente. Et cette discrétion-là est exercée par la police. Il y a déjà eu d'ailleurs des cas à Montréal de personnes qui se sont retrouvées à se faire arrêter avec du matériel, et ces cas-là ne se sont jamais retrouvées devant un tribunal quelconque. En fait, elles ont été annulées. Elles sont restées dans les limbes des postes de quartier et des CO de Montréal. Une deuxième remarque avant de continuer aussi, et l'opposition qui a été menée en fait dans la défense du gouvernement conservateur et qui est souvent présente dans les discussions qui concernent la réduction des méfaits, c'est l'opposition constante entre réduction des méfaits et le modèle de l'abstinence, qui est une opposition à sens unique, c'est-à-dire que c'est souvent une opposition qui nous vient de certains services en abstinence, mais que les projets en réduction des méfaits ne mène pas ce discours-là, en général, parce qu'on est les principales personnes qui référons vers des services en abstinence. Je pense que le raisonnement de notre part, en tout cas, il se base là-dessus. Si les personnes décident d'arrêter de consommer, d'aller en thérapie, des intoxications, c'est notre travail de leur fournir l'accès à ces services-là, et c'est bien souvent le seul moyen pour des personnes très marginalisées d'accéder à ces services-là de toute façon. Donc ce discours-là, cette opposition-là qui est souvent en fait, ne tient pas à l'analyse des budgets qui sont alloués à l'un et à l'autre, parce qu'il y a beaucoup plus d'argent investi dans les programmes en abstinence que d'argent investi en réduction des méfaits. Encore plus d'argent qui est investi dans pour appliquer le code criminel d'ailleurs. Donc cette analyse-là, elle tient moyennement, mais elle était présente dans ce qui a été présenté par le gouvernement fédéral en Cour suprême. Maintenant, on va revenir sur l'impact de cette décision à Cactus. Et je suis assez d'accord avec vous quand vous dites qu'elle est assez étroite. Pour nous, elle nous pose en fait tout un ensemble de normes, parce qu'on travaille actuellement sur le dépôt d'une exemption pour mettre en place des services d'injection supervisés à Montréal généralement et à Cactus en particulier en ce qui nous concerne. Là où on est rassuré, c'est sur notre dossier en réalité. Au niveau de l'intensité des services qui sont fournis, Cactus c'est 40 000 visites par année. Si vous faites le calcul, c'est beaucoup plus que 150 visites par jour. Et aussi un contexte de consommation qui est très différent de Vancouver, avec une consommation majoritairement de cocaïne. Pour la pratique, un consommateur d'héroïne va consommer 3 injections par jour. Dans la moyenne, un consommateur de cocaïne sur une bilge, ça va être 15 injections par jour. Donc l'intensité d'utilisation du service est complètement différente dans le contexte d'une demande d'exemption et multiplie les impacts sur la santé aussi. Pour les personnes, vous avez vu dans le film l'impact sur les veines. Quand on change de 3 à 15 injections, vous imaginez les dégâts que ça peut causer sur un capital veineux, comme on dit dans le milieu. Les scènes publiques d'injection aussi qui sont à l'est de Saint-Laurent, entre Saint-Laurent et Amherst, très fréquente. Vous pouvez marcher n'importe quel coin de rue, va avoir du matériel de consommation par terre. S'il y a du matériel, quelqu'un s'est injecté là. Cet aspect-là, les overdoses aussi, parce qu'on avait un manque au Québec vis-à-vis du coroner, donc de documenter les morts par overdose. Depuis maintenant 3 ans, il y a un souci du coroner de mieux documenter ces morts-là, ces morts regrettables-là. Et depuis ces 3 années-là, on sent une augmentation. De l'année dernière à cette année, on a une augmentation de 25%. C'est passé de 50 de morts par overdose au Québec à 75 en une année, ce qui est quand même assez significatif. C'est dû à des changements au niveau des consommateurs d'opiacés qui switchent de l'héroïne vers des opiacés médicamenteux, prennent plus de risques et donc plus de morts par overdose. L'étroitesse du jugement, donc, elle est réelle dans le sens où pour nous, ça nous oblige à avoir tout un set de normes au niveau des professionnels de la santé qui seront sur place, des installations, dans les ressources. Beaucoup de craintes aussi de la part de la santé publique, d'appréhension qui ralentissent le processus d'installation. On est comme dans l'urgence d'installer ces services-là depuis 2000. Une urgence qui dure 12 ans. Mais une chose qui nous rassure, c'est que c'est principalement une opposition politique. C'est à la discrétion du ministre. Les gouvernements sont élus pour 5 ans. Cactus existe depuis 23 ans. Sur la durée, je pense qu'on est capable de gagner aussi ces combats-là. Et quand on regarde l'étroitesse du jugement, bien souvent, dans notre domaine, on s'inspire de l'étranger. Et la Suisse a montré un certain courage politique, étant donné les incompatibilités entre sa loi criminelle et les programmes en réduction des méfaits. Ils ont choisi de modifier leur constitution pour établir les services en réduction des méfaits dans leur constitution. Comme ça, la question ne se posait plus à chaque nouveau service qui voyait le jour, mais établissez une norme claire sur les services en réduction des méfaits. Je vais m'arrêter là, parce que je pense que Louis avait des remarques. Donc, bonne soirée, puis merci de votre attention.
Thank you so much. It's not often that we actually get to hear a different perspective, not a legal perspective, but actually a perspective of how the law is hitting people on the ground, so to speak. So I found that incredibly interesting, and I'd like to thank you very much for bringing that perspective. I would indeed take this opportunity to invite Monsieur Louis Letellier de Saint-Just to come up and say a few words. As I mentioned earlier, he represented Cactus in its intervention in this case in the Supreme Court, and I'm sure he has a few things to say that have not yet been said.
Thank you very much. I was not necessarily prepared to talk to you tonight, or at least to say a few words. Thanks to have that kind of setting. As you said, it's very interesting to have a point of view from the ground, not only on a legal basis, but we have to understand why these decisions are tabled. Très rapidement, sans faire trop de coq à l'âne, vous savez, c'est une décision, I'm talking more than an activist, than a lawyer tonight. Ça fait 23 ans, j'ai été un membre fondateur de Cactus il y a 23 ans. le contexte dans lequel les organismes communautaires interviennent auprès des personnes toxicomanes est un contexte qui n'est pas connu de la grande majorité de la population. Lorsque l'on entend des récriminations ou des oppositions à des efforts communautaires de réduction des méfaits pour une population qui est excessivement démunie, vous n'avez aucune idée de la détresse que ces gens-là vivent au quotidien. Aujourd'hui, après 23 ans, les efforts de mettre en place des services d'injection supervisés à Montréal font l'objet d'opposition. C'est normal. Vous savez, c'est une question de valeur, d'opposition. Il faut écouter ceux et celles qui ont des positions différentes. Il faut, à l'inverse, écouter ceux et celles qui veulent soutenir différemment, comme on l'a fait depuis si longtemps avec la politique de tolérance zéro par rapport aux drogues, calquée sur une politique américaine. Il faut aussi maintenant écouter les nouvelles preuves, écouter les nouvelles approches pour être capable de s'adresser à qui? S'adresser à des êtres humains qui ont perdu leur dignité au fil des ans et qu'une société repousse. Cette décision-là est une décision excessivement importante. Malgré son étroitesse, je peux être d'accord avec cette analyse juridique, mais malgré son étroitesse, c'est excessivement rare que vous avez une cour, la plus haute cour d'un pays, qui viendra dire « la dépendance aux opiacés est une maladie ». Si dans le milieu de la toxicomanie ou de l'addictologie, comme on le dit en Europe, c'est connu, les praticiens le savent, que la toxicomanie, que la dépendance aux drogues est une maladie, mais qu'une cour vienne le dire, c'est excessivement important pour la suite des choses. Il y a 10 jours, je donnais une conférence à Genève dans un contexte où des pays francophones se réunissaient sur la question de la dépendance ou du traitement de la dépendance aux opioïdes. On m'avait demandé de donner une conférence sur la décision d'Insight en l'intitulant « Les droits de l'homme au chevet du traitement de la dépendance aux opiacés ». Et c'est juste. La décision de la Cour suprême était au chevet, sur la base des droits fondamentaux, de la question de la lutte contre la drogue. L'impact d'une décision comme celle de la Cour suprême dans le dossier PHS ou Insight, ça dépasse largement les frontières canadiennes. Largement. La France attendait avec beaucoup d'impatience cette décision-là. Pour ceux et celles qui ont pu lire ici et là dans les journaux, le gouvernement français refuse systématiquement d'ouvrir la porte, tout comme le fait le gouvernement canadien ici, à d'autres manières en matière de réduction des méfaits, d'autres manières que les programmes de distribution de seringues. Donc, cette décision-là a quand même eu un impact, d'une certaine manière, j'ose croire, parce que tout récemment, le gouvernement français, nouvellement élu, a ouvert la porte à une discussion différente. La Suisse attendait aussi avec beaucoup d'impatience. Comme Jean-François l'a mentionné, la Suisse, dès la fin des années 80, même un peu avant, avait déjà modifié sa politique nationale sur les drogues pour ouvrir avec une approche basée sur les droits de la personne. Donc, c'est un pays précurseur sur lequel on s'est basé pour changer les choses en Espagne, changer les choses en Allemagne, changer les choses au Portugal, changer les choses en Australie. Donc, il y a des impacts importants. Ici, dans la décision de la Cour, vous ne trouverez aucune mention, ou en fait soutenue, à l'effet que ailleurs dans le monde, nous avons plus, quoi, une 70 sites d'injection supervisés ailleurs dans le monde. La Cour n'a pas non plus retenu les arguments que le groupe auquel j'appartenais, le réseau juridique canadien VIH-SIDA, Harm Reduction de Londres et Cactus, basé sur les documents internationaux, sur les grands outils de droit internationaux. La Cour n'a pas retenu ces arguments-là, ne l'a même pas mentionné. Est-ce qu'ils ont considéré que ce n'était pas nécessaire, compte tenu de l'orientation qu'ils ont prise? Possiblement. Mais ça aurait été intéressant de voir qu'une Cour aurait pu prendre les moyens pour dire « voici ce qui se dit sur le plan international », d'autant plus que le Canada est signataire de conventions en matière de lutte contre la drogue et aussi en matière de réduction des méfaits. Cette décision-là aussi, c'est une victoire pour les organismes communautaires qui, depuis déjà quelques années, dont le réseau juridique canadien VIH-SIDA, prennent d'assaut les tribunaux. Ils sont même prêts à se rendre jusqu'en Cour suprême. Insight est un très bon exemple. La décision dans l'affaire Cuirier, qui a donné d'autres résultats récemment avec les affaires Mébieux du Manitoba et DC ici au Québec, sur la question de la révélation de son statut sérologique à son partenaire lors de relations sexuelles, est aussi un bon exemple de la manière dont les organismes communautaires et les personnes touchées prennent d'assaut les tribunaux. Évidemment, tout ça coûte des sous, vous le savez, vous êtes des praticiens pour la grande majorité d'entre vous. Il y a un changement aussi qui s'opère dans le milieu de la défense des droits des organismes communautaires qui n'ont pas d'argent pour se rendre en principe devant ces tribunaux-là, mais avec le support de grands cabinets canadiens, ces organismes-là, dont Cactus, dont le réseau juridique canadien VIH, peuvent maintenant penser à affronter un gouvernement qui prend des décisions qui semblent non conformes à la Charte canadienne et à la défense des droits et libertés. Mais il y a un coût à payer, il y a un prix à payer. Des choses que vous ne savez pas, c'est qu'au lendemain de cette décision-là, le gouvernement fédéral a été excessivement vindicatif, puisque pour plusieurs organismes communautaires œuvrant dans le secteur de la défense des droits, des subventions ont été coupées. The Canadian Legal HIV/AIDS Network was cut from Public Health Canada grant from 75%. C'est une subvention d'à peu près 650-700 000 $ par année, coupée pratiquement à zéro. C'est un impact majeur. La décision est une décision politique, en fonction des travaux et des démarches que les organismes communautaires font. Et ça, c'est dommage, mais il faut que ça se sache. Autre élément, et je ne veux pas me perdre trop longtemps pour vous permettre de poser certaines questions, il y a des éléments dont il faut retenir au niveau de la décision de la Cour. La Cour a encadré, il y avait trois questions à litige, mais la Cour, pour une de celles-là, c'était « Est-ce que le ministre a bien exercé, comme Alana l'a mentionné, sa discrétion? » Les lendemains de cette cause-là, c'est important. Je suis un petit peu, j'ai une opinion un peu différente de celle de notre collègue par rapport à l'impact de la décision pour les autres provinces canadiennes. Il y a un impact positif. Une décision comme celle-là ne peut pas permettre à d'autres, c'est-à-dire on doit avoir, au contraire, c'est une décision qui a créé tellement d'espoir pour les autres provinces canadiennes qui veulent aller de l'avant. Actuellement, vous avez l'Ontario, la Colombie-Britannique qui revient, comme Jean-François l'a mentionné, avec deux autres possibles demandes d'exemption en vertu de la loi canadienne sur les drogues, le Manitoba aussi, la Nouvelle-Écosse. Donc, il y a un impact positif. Chaque décision ou chaque demande faite au ministre de la Santé va amener une décision particulière, mais encadrée. Et dans cet encadrement-là, il y a des facteurs à considérer. La Cour a dit que le ministre devait considérer l'incidence du centre ou de l'organisme sur le taux de criminalité, les conditions locales qui indiquent qu'un service d'injection supervisée répond à un besoin, la structure réglementaire, son organisation interne, ses protocoles, les ressources aussi disponibles pour pourvoir à son entretien et à son maintien. Mais la Cour a ajouté un autre élément. Et c'est là où la Cour nous donne à penser qu'elle a peut-être décidé un peu trop rapidement. C'est une décision qui a été rendue en 4 mois et demi. C'est assez exceptionnel, c'est intéressant. Mais évidemment, quand on se presse pour rendre une décision comme celle-là, on risque d'échapper quelque chose. En disant que le ministre devra aussi tenir compte, dans son analyse d'une demande d'exemption en vertu de la loi canadienne sur les drogues, tenir compte des appuis ou des oppositions de la communauté. Et ça devra être documenté dans chaque demande d'exemption. Alors, je ne sais pas si vous vous rendez compte de la portée de ce dernier élément qui encadre l'exercice du pouvoir discrétionnaire du ministre, mais c'est à la fois dire, voici nous, la Cour suprême, nous avons dit que la loi canadienne sur les drogues en matière de possession venait enfreindre les droits à la liberté, à la sécurité et à la liberté à la fois du personnel, mais aussi beaucoup des usagers. Mais on va aussi donner à la population la possibilité de donner au ministre une emprise pour refuser la demande d'exemption en disant « nous, on n'en veut pas dans notre quartier ». Alors, cette question de l'acceptabilité sociale, c'est excessivement dangereux. D'abord, comment est-ce que ça se mesure? Si vous avez, dans le centre-ville de Montréal, 100, 150 personnes qui appartiennent à des organisations propriétaires de condominiums qui ne sont même pas autour de l'endroit où les services se donnent, ce qui est le cas de Cactus, est-ce qu'on peut dire qu'il y a une opposition sociale importante? Alors, cet aspect-là de la décision qui encadre le pouvoir discrétionnaire du ministre, elle est inquiétante. Et ce sont des choses qu'on va devoir aussi considérer. Un dernier élément avant de terminer. C'est assez curieux de voir à quel point le gouvernement fédéral actuel s'acharne, et on l'a vu dans les propos de l'ex-ministre Tony Clements, passablement enragé par rapport à cette orientation, par rapport à des services de santé donnés dans une province depuis 2002. Dr. Peter a été là même en 2001, avant Insight. Alors, c'est assez curieux de voir l'acharnement du gouvernement actuel dans sa politique en matière de drogue, alors que depuis 23 ans, partout au Canada, vous avez plusieurs programmes d'échange de seringues et aucun n'a obtenu une demande d'exemption en vertu de la même loi. Et jamais le gouvernement fédéral ne s'est-il objecté ou n'a-t-il fait obstruction pour exiger qu'on ait une demande d'exemption. Cactus opère depuis 23 ans dans ce secteur-là. Jamais il n'a obtenu ni demandé de demande d'exemption. Alors que dans les faits, on devrait le faire. C'est exactement le même contexte. Le gouvernement provincial québécois, comme tous les autres gouvernements provinciaux, ont soutenu les programmes d'échange de seringues à travers le pays. Mais le gouvernement fédéral n'a jamais soulevé cette incongruité-là par rapport à sa lutte acharnée dans le dossier des services d'injection supervisée. Ça fait plus de 23 ans, les temps ont changé. Je vous dis que ce n'est pas une panacée. Un service d'injection supervisée n'est pas une panacée. Ce n'est pas une solution qui va tout régler les problèmes, loin de là. C'est une invitation à des gens qu'on a de la difficulté à rejoindre autrement. Des personnes qui ne vont pas dans les services de santé, et c'est documenté. Heureusement, après 23 ans, on a pu accumuler des preuves scientifiques. On les a maintenant. Dans la décision d'Insight, la Cour a littéralement giflé le ministère de la Santé et son ministre en disant « Vous avez été exagérément disproportionné et vous avez agi de façon excessive et arbitraire parce que vous n'avez pas tenu compte des preuves scientifiques déposées. Et vous n'en avez même pas déposé vous-même. » Le ministre est même allé jusqu'à dire « Je n'ai jamais rendu de décision par rapport à Insight. Je ne me suis jamais prononcé. » Ça a été un des arguments en première instance. On a même argumenté du côté du procureur général du Canada que la toxicomanie était un choix. Ils avaient par contre oublié, et la Cour suprême leur a rappelé, qu'ils ne se sont pas objectés lorsqu'on a mentionné que la dépendance était une maladie. Alors leur argument sur la question du choix devenait fallacieux, même on leur a jeté du revers de la main. Alors ça a été véritablement, je me souviens du matin où, vous savez comment ça fonctionne, la Cour suprême nous avise quelques jours auparavant, 9h30, tel matin, la décision sera disponible sur le site internet de la Cour suprême. Alors vous pouvez vous imaginer qu'à 9h30, il y a presque un an de ça, tous les organismes et toutes les entités canadiennes préoccupées par la question des droits se sont précipités sur le site pour avoir la décision. À notre grand étonnement, c'est une décision unanime. Les 9 juges. Vous savez, faut être assez humble quand on a cette chance de plaider devant la Cour suprême et qu'on en sort, on regarde les juges, on analyse leurs moindres gestes, leur rictus, le nombre de questions, leur acharnement par rapport à un plaideur. Et on peut se dire, we're gonna win it or we're gonna lose it. Dans cette décision-là, on avait, comme on dit en chinois, un bon feeling. Mais jamais on n'aurait pensé que la décision serait unanime. Jamais. Alors c'est une décision qui a un poids considérable, qui n'a pas encore été testée. Le ministère fédéral connaît aussi les trous aussi bien que nous. Qui ira en premier? C'est une stratégie qui se joue des deux côtés. Et je dois vous dire que les organismes canadiens qui sont intéressés à aller de l'avant, dont l'Agence de santé de Montréal, qui va supporter 4 projets pour la région de Montréal. Et d'ailleurs, Montréal n'est pas Vancouver. Vancouver, c'est un quartier. Montréal, la problématique de la toxicomanie, elle est répandue à travers différents quartiers. D'où la décision d'amener 4 projets avec une unité mobile qui couvrira des heures non couvertes par les services comme tels. Ces 4 services-là, quand verront-ils le jour? Je ne me prononce plus sur la date ni même l'année. Tout ce qu'on peut souhaiter, c'est qu'un jour, on ait cette ouverture d'esprit pour permettre à des gens de retrouver leur dignité, de retrouver une certaine santé en leur ouvrant des portes vers lesquelles ils viennent déjà. Alors, merci.
That was incredibly powerful. Thank you so much. So as you can see, this year we're not shying away from controversial issues. And if you look at the program that we have set for the rest of the year, and particularly next time's program, we are going to be tackling an equally controversial issue, which is physician-assisted suicide. A recent BC Supreme Court decision, a first instance, so it's the only time that we're going to depart from Supreme Court cases. This case is definitely on its way up to the Supreme Court. It's the Carter case, and some of you may remember the Rodriguez case of several years ago. This case is seen to say something a little bit different from that one, and we will have 2 wonderful speakers. We have Professor Margot Somerville, who's here tonight, as well as Professor Daniel Weinstock, who will be speaking on that. So I hope to see you all at our next session on November 27th. For those of you who would like to stay another 5 or so minutes, I'm sure our panelists would love to answer any questions. Does anybody have any questions that they would like to ask? I know it's hot, and you'd all like to get out of this room. Good night.